Amen. Thank you for coming in here today. I kind of was a little nervous. Carl and I were here 15 minutes early. I was thinking, nobody's going to come. Oh, no. There is a part of me that would love to be in the other sessions right now. And the reasoning is there. There's some practical implications that are taking place in each one of those sessions. I'd love to be in the one with my wife right now. She gets so nervous. She is a tremendous one-on-one person, and she is a tremendous group person. If you have ever been around a pastor's wife that just connects with people, that's my wife. And some of you know Joanna and know that to be true of her. One of the neat things about her is she is good in a group like this, but she gets so nervous. So if it wouldn't bother me if you guys say a quick prayer for her over there. She's leading the time. She has been doing some substitute teaching, and one of the neat things about her through the years, we've had Christian schools in the different ministries I've been a part of, but she wants to be a part of the public school ministry because she has that outreach, and some neat things are happening. She's seen people come to the Lord through her ministry through the years. Just a couple weeks ago, she said one of the ladies she was talking with had an issue, had a problem, and Joanna said to her, well, can we pray about it? And so they prayed. And the lady said to her, can we do this every day? And so every day now, Joanna's on an extended sub thing, subbing for somebody that had a surgery, and every day this lady comes in and prays with her. And there was one day that they skipped there, and she came back, and the lady was just all apologetic because she wasn't a part of that. So these are tremendous opportunities there. And I know she's going to be sharing some things with the ladies over there from a very practical standpoint. Marshall Fant's doing this one on youth ministry in the 21st century. He's a great young man doing a great work there. And, of course, Carl told you the connection there with Harvest Baptist Church, our good friends, and that are up there. And then Rusty Smith is doing one on church development and growth. I had the privilege of preaching down at Mikado Baptist Church this past summer. He's got a thriving ministry down there. Rusty's a friend from years past, graduate of Tennessee Temple. He and my wife were in school together. Joanna was in their weddings, best friends with his wife. And so a lot of neat connections there. I wish I was going to be a part of that. When Pastor Yarborough said, wanted me to be a part of this particular workshop, I thought, you know, when I think about it, this is one of those things of you probably would want an older guy that's been a part of the ministry for so many years that can come back and tell all these stories. But then I got to thinking about the stories that I do have and the years that I do have in experience and the different seasons that we've gone through. I started pastoring when I was 24 years of age, graduated from Bob Jones. My story's kind of an interesting thing in that I was a part of University Baptist Church in Clemson, and a lot of you are familiar with that ministry. But I was the youngest charter member in that church. We were three families that helped start that ministry right there. Hugh McCoy was the founding pastor, and then after several years, Pastor Will Sin came in, and I love his name. It's a great name for a pastor. I used to tease him about that. Pastor Will Sin. Of course he will. But I was with them for a little bit. So after grad school, I had the privilege of going over and working at University Baptist Church for a while there. It was interesting, my story. Let me just tell you a little bit of the backstory for me. We grew up in a Southern Baptist church. I grew up in a Southern Baptist church. And like I said, when I was 10, we left that because my dad, and I remember the words specifically, he said, we're tired of playing church. And that was the quote that stuck out to me as a young man. He said, we're tired of playing church. And so we began to look, and we went to this ministry where we were giving up a wonderful youth program. And I was about to enter into that age of being in the youth group and going into a place with just a small group. But I'll tell you, there was an intimacy with those families there. And we started working. We started praying. We started getting together. We were together almost every weekend, as far as Fridays and Saturdays. And the Lord really used that to kind of mold me. I went to public school all the way through. I was saved at the age of 9. How many of you know the name J. Harold Smith? He was my granddad's first cousin. And I went to hear him preach. And I still remember when he confronted me, he said to me, young man, are you sure you're going to heaven? Well, I was going down. He didn't know me. He's a cousin. He was with the Radio Bible Hour. If you've ever driven across and turned on him, he was there. He died in his mid-90s, about 10 years ago. But it hit me. I know I wasn't saved. And so it was neat the way the Lord worked in my heart there, and I was saved that afternoon as my dad led me to Christ. But again, growing up to a public school all the way through, I was one of those kids, and maybe you're here, that said I would never go to Bob Jones University. And I made that statement, but I had a call of the Lord that was starting to work in my life. At that time, I was one also that said, I will never be a preacher. I had a scholarship to go to Clemson University, and our senior class trip, again, a public school, we took a cruise to the Bahamas. Now, you can imagine what that was like. And it was there that I had my eyes open, really, to the world and what was going on in the world. And I just thought, you know, I need some discipline. I need to know why I believe what I believe. And I'll go to Bob Jones for a year. But that year, at the Lord just worked in my heart. I got heavily involved in my society, had great prayer groups. I was in one of his prayer groups, I think, my sophomore year. We were together, or maybe it was a junior year. Anyway, we had great friends on the campus, and the Lord started working. I worked at the Wilds, worked here 4 summers, thought I was going to end up coming full time. It was just God's redirecting along the way. And I'm going to tell you a real interesting thing about this. This is all setting a little bit of the stage for where we're going to go, about the way God works, because we don't always understand what He's doing. As I was finishing up at Bob Jones, met my wife, as I said last night, here at the Wilds. Again, she was from Tennessee Temple. We became best friends, and that's who you need to marry, is if she's a she, your best friend. In today's society, you don't take that for granted, do you? But you want to get somebody like that. So I married Joanna, worked in Clemson at UBC with Pastor Sin for a year. And while there, we had a man come from Rock Hill. You know Lonnie Schmidt. Lonnie came and visited us. And I remember going off in the parking lot on the bus praying that the Lord would call a pastor to Rock Hill. And not even thinking a thing about it. At that same time, Marsh Fant had graduated from Clemson, I believe. He was in our church. He's 10, 12 years older than me. Working at Fant's Office Supply, which was the oldest family-owned business in the state of South Carolina. If you drive through Anderson, you're going to go across Fant Street one time or another. Just very prominent family there in the area. Marsh was coming to our church there, and we had a missions conference, and Marsh surrendered to the ministry. And this was all right around the same time God was starting to work in my heart about going to Rock Hill. And again, at that same time where things were turning, where we were moving away from the Wilds more into a local church type situation. And not knowing what the Lord was doing at the time, I went and visited Rock Hill, and we ended up going and starting that church. But what is interesting, after 4 years, Marsh surrendered to the ministry at that same time, went to BJ, got his MDiv, took him that long to get it. At the end of that, I had him come speak a Valentine's banquet. God just took away the ministry there. We were doing better numerically and physically or financially than we'd ever done. And I sought a counsel. What did we hear last night? In a multitude of counselors, there's safety. I was talking to a lot of guys up here that I was talking to. And just really praying and seeking the Lord's will. And it was so evident He was leading us away to a next phase of ministry. And we're going to be talking about the phases of ministry. I didn't know what that meant. In fact, they tell you not to do this. If you're a pastor and you don't know where you're going, don't step out. Don't resign. But it was God's will, and I knew that. And I stepped aside, and Marsh stepped in doing pulpit supply, and then they called him as the pastor. I still remember laying hands on him in the ordination. And we were in Clemson. I remember it hit me all of a sudden. We were praying that God would send a pastor to Rock Hill, and I thought I was that man. But God was calling Marsh, and I was just a vehicle that God was using to get that ministry off of the ground and get something established where He could take it to a totally different level. It was very humbling, but it was also very exciting to see the way God was using us. And again, we ended up in Muncie, Indiana for 4 years under Dr. Glenn. At Grace Baptist Church, they had lost their youth pastor and their assistant pastor. So I was doing basically 2 jobs when I went out there. And it didn't take long for me to know. And I knew I was going to be a senior pastor again. But it was one of those things that as a young man, and I would encourage young men to understand, if you're going into something, this is a great opportunity to get under a mentor like that, to get established in a ministry and be able to learn. And we had Dr. Glenn, we had Dr. Dennis Ice was on the faculty there, or on the staff. He's the director of the Indiana Association of Christian Schools. God used all of that to work in my life, also to take me in a direction that would eventually end up in churches with Christian schools. And that last year I was there, it was just getting kind of tough, because here Dr. Glenn was an older guy, here I was the young buck. People were saying, you need to let Jeff preach all the time, or, you know, pretty much, you need to let him preach on Sunday mornings, you know. I went to him, I said, listen, I love you, I'm here to support you, I'm here to help you, I don't want to hurt you. And you see that in a lot of ministries right now, because there are a lot of older guys that are transitioning, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. Next steps, what are those going to be? And the Lord worked in my heart in a way that I just said to him, I said, I think it's time I start looking. And he said, Jeff, you're a senior pastor. You need to be out. And what was interesting about that, Carl, is I had heard from churches from day one when I went there. And now the well was dry. I went 6 months without hearing anything from a church. And I thought, well, Lord, what are you doing here? I'm willing. I've said I'm willing. And I went to Dr. Glenn one day and I said, here's the deal, Pastor. I think either there's a church that's not ready, or I'm not ready. And it's probably both. And so we just continued to pray and sought the Lord's will. And it was just about a month later, Tabernacle called me. And the thing that was interesting when I said the church wasn't ready is the former pastor had not resigned yet. Normally it takes, I've heard a statistic, and I don't know if it's true, but I've seen it play out a lot. I don't know the metrics on this. But if a pastor's been in a ministry for 10 years, it normally takes about 10 months to at least find a pastor. Usually there's something that goes similar in line with that. And he resigned, and so he had been there for a long time. He'd been there for in the teens as far as the years of pastoring in Wilson. But he resigned 1 month. The next month, I was down preaching for him. I preached Mother's Day, went back and preached preached Memorial Day. Is that whatever the order is? I preached Memorial Day first, went back Mother's Day. They called me, and Father's Day was my first Sunday as their pastor. So it was very, very quick. And again, we were there 10 years, and we saw the Lord do some incredible things in that ministry, eventually relocating the church. And now we're in Anderson, South Carolina. My dad passed away in 2009 unexpectedly, and the Lord has just providentially led us. It was 8 months after the fact that the Lord led us to Oakwood Baptist, which was 20 minutes away from where my mom lived, and she's a member of our church now, and she's since moved to Anderson. And one of the neat things about it, and this will blow your mind, maybe not your mind, but it blew my mind. When my wife and I were in Dr. Fremont's apartment, you remember Dr. Fremont's apartments in Greenville, some of you know that, that's where we our first home, I looked over at her and said, wouldn't it be neat if the Lord put us in a church like Oakwood one day? And it was 20 years later that we get the call from Oakwood. So we see just God's providential work, and you don't know. And throughout those different ministry stages or different places I've been, I've seen the Lord work, and I've seen certain things that have kind of stood out in ministry. And I want us to go through the little outline I put here. And I don't have a real I'm out of my comfort zone here in a way, because normally I preach straight through the Scriptures. I want to just share one verse of Scripture. That's Ephesians 5:22. And then we're going to kind of work our way through the phases of ministry here. Or 5:21, excuse me. I love 22. 22 could be a life verse. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husband. It's verse 21 I want us to kind of think about for just a second. And I want us to consider also the context of what's being said in Ephesians chapter 5. Because in Ephesians chapter 5, obviously, Paul is now moved to the practical side of ministry. He's talking about the practical side after he's given all the doctrine here. Okay, this is how you apply this to your lives. And of course, the key thought of Ephesians, the identification that we have with Jesus Christ and how our walk is to be carried out. And again, we see those tremendous doctrinal truths in chapter 1, one of the weightiest chapters in the Scriptures. But we get to chapter 5 and he's saying how this ought to be laid out. And he's talking about how we walk in love and how your walk is going to be different than that of the world. And then he's talking about how we're to be proving what is acceptable unto the Lord. And as we work our way through that, we get to that great verse on redeeming the time. And then we come to Ephesians 5:18. You know, when you stand up and preach, what you need to be filled with the Spirit. We think when we pray, we need to be filled with the Spirit. Be not drunk with wine, where is excess, but be filled with the Spirit. And so we use that, and a lot of times we use that. But if you really ever consider the context of Ephesians 5:18, being filled with the Spirit, the context is going to be talking about our homes and our families. And so when we're thinking about seasons of ministry change and seasons of change from the husband's perspective, how many of you in here are in the pastorate or missionaries in here? How many are like that? Anybody in here that's, you're just a layman that's with us? You're not just a layman. Anybody at all? Okay. So we all can understand that. But this would apply even to somebody that's just in your church here, the idea of the different phases that you're going to go through. Brother Steve back here is about to enter into a little different phase. Been here almost 20 years working around here. Six or eight years out in Colorado working. Been with the Wild since he got married, since he got out of college. And now he's entering into a different phase. He's going to be heading up to the New England area to be with the camp up that way. A different change. We go through phases that are there. And it affects you. It affects your children. It affects your wife. And what we need to be sure is, first of all, God is in the plan. It's God's will for what we're doing. We're not just running because we're trying to get away from problems. One of the worst things you can do is think the grass is greener on the other side and go run into the grass somewhere else, only to find out that you've got dandelions that just haven't sprouted up yet. You know, they haven't started to bloom. Or like my yard right now, we've got these gorgeous purple little weeds all over our yard. And I put the weed and feed that out. You know, I'm like, Lord, what are you doing with my yard? I don't have time to mess with this. But the grass isn't greener. There's always problems wherever you go. So we don't want to just run from that. We want to be running. If we're leaving, make sure it's the Lord leading us to do that. Now, He may be leading you to do that. He led us to do that. We've been involved in different stages, and we're going to see how it all plays out. But the key verse I want us to understand, yeah, we love our wives. Our wives are to submit. We're to play our roles. Families, children are to obey their parents. But verse 21 sets the stage for the whole thing. And that's the idea that we're submitting ourselves one to another. In other words, we're talking about our families, that we are supporting one another, we're involved with one another's lives, we know what the Lord is doing there. Now, let's move real quickly as we look at the outline today, because with that as a foundation, understanding God being invited into this, God is doing something. And one of the things that's been interesting in my studies, and I'm not an expert on this, but I have seen in my own life, I've seen it play out in friends' lives, I've seen it play out in many, many books that I read. I've kind of agonized over this because there's so many different ways you could approach this particular topic. But I want to be just intensely practical right now and just get us thinking about different stages and where we are in our lives. And while we're thinking through these stages, think about how that affects our families. Okay, real quickly in here, let's go around the room real quickly. I want to know how long you've been married, okay? I'm going to give you a second for some of you to think, okay? Because I assume, and if you're single, just say I'm single, but I'm not sure if that applies to anybody. But let's just kind of work our way through the room. And if you have kids, let me know if you have kids. If you have grandkids, let me know if you have grandkids, okay? Tim?
27.
27.
Three kids.
No grandkids. Okay.
39. Five grandchildren.
Okay.
48, two kids, two grands.
Okay.
5 years, one child and one on the way.
Okay.
4 years, no kids.
Okay.
33 years, four girls.
47, two children, five grandchildren, two great grandchildren.
Wow. 51 years, one daughter and two grandchildren.
Amen.
39 years, two daughters.
Good.
26 years, four kids.
Okay.
29 years, three children.
Yes, sir. Steve.
22 years, four kids.
Okay, John.
15 years, six children.
Okay, Mark.
38 years, married, two children, five grandchildren.
Okay.
26 and three.
Okay. So everybody here is married, and you're going to be in different stages. And you're going to hear as I'm doing this, of course, I'm kind of approaching it from where I've been, and hopefully that'll help you a little bit. But I don't have grandkids, but my son just got married in August, and you know, things happen, and I may be a grandfather. It may not be too long, but he's in seminary right now, and Lord's working in his heart about direction and calling, and it's really exciting. So he, even as I was looking through this, I was thinking about his stage, where he was in his life. What is the Lord doing in his life? What's the Lord doing in my life? I remember it was at Tabernacle several years ago. We had just moved there. I had Mike Maynor in for a revival meeting. And many of you know Brother Mike, and he had come in and he preached. And Caleb came forward at the end of the service. I think he was about 8 years old. And he knelt down at the altar, and as he was kneeling there, he looked at me. He was like, "Dad, come down here." And so I got down by Caleb, and he says, "I don't know." He said, "I just feel God wants me to be an evangelist." 8 year old. And I looked at him. I said, "Caleb, you don't want to be an evangelist." And he said, "No, I'm serious." And I said, "Yeah, I'm serious too." I said, "Is God doing this in your heart?" And we talked a little bit. And it was right after that that he went to the Wilds, and it was the first year of junior boot camp, first year that they did the junior boot camp here. And we had brought our teens here, and he comes running across the whatever it's called up there, general headquarters area, comes running across after one of the service. Big Bob had preached that day. He comes running over to me. He says, "Dad, I surrendered to preach." Okay. Next year, he comes running across. "Dad, I really surrendered to preach." And then a year later, "I really, really surrendered." And, you know, so we had him preaching, and he preached in North Carolina, and he actually won the state in the academic contest one time in preaching. And then he didn't preach for a long, long time. And I was thinking, well, Lord, were you calling him? I don't know. Senior year, he's wrestling. He's being recruited to go play sports at different colleges. And he's just, and I'm like, "Caleb, I'm not going to tell you where to go. I'm praying for you." He said, "Just tell me." "I can't do that." I said, "But why would you go here? Why would you go here if it wasn't the..." Anyway, we had these conversations. He ended up at BJ. He ended up playing on the first Bruins basketball team, got to play on that. So he did get to live the dream for himself. But all that time, his senior year, the Lord started working. He's worked here at the Wilds for summers. He's been a lead counselor a couple years. The Lord started working in his heart, and he's totally committed now to go in ministry. And so the Lord works. That first phase I want to call is the call phase. The call phase. Do you remember when you were called? Do you remember what it was like? For me personally, I was called not like some guys that just, I mean, it's like, you know, it's like they knew all of a sudden. For me, it wasn't like that. It was my first summer working at camp. I was a lifeguard here. And I started doing a study on the will of God. And in that study on the will of God, I took the Thompson Chain Reference Bible, and I went through the chains of that, and I went through the different verses on God's will, and I came across the one where it says, "If any man will do my Father's will, he will know of the doctrine." And God used the Word of God to lead me in the will of God. Because at the time when I was going to go to Clemson, I was going to be in graphic arts. When I ended up at Bob Jones, I started in computers, changed my major to business, and I had no idea where I was going to end up going. Again, counseling with a lot of folks, the Lord said, "Just give me the benefit of the doubt." And so I entered the School of Religion. I ended up being a church administration major. Notice I did not want to be a Bible major. I wasn't ready to go there. Because I knew some Bible major. No, just kidding. No, I just wasn't really ready to just commit to being that. So, but I ended up taking Bible classes, took Greek as an elective, didn't have to do that. And it was just these little things along the way that the Lord used in my own heart and life where I went through a door. What really sealed it for me was right after doing that, Pastor Sin said, "Jeff, you're preaching next Sunday night." I said, "Whoa, I'm not called to preach." "No, you're preaching next Sunday night." And I said, "I wouldn't even know how to start. I didn't have any books. I didn't have any guidance. He didn't sit down and show me how to do an outline." I developed an outline which was not an expository masterpiece by any means. It was an acrostic in the book of Acts, and I still remember it. It was how to have power in the church, and I highlighted just different things in the church in Acts, and you have to have prayer. And there has to be that obedience. And you have to have your witness. And see, I thought long and hard about this. Okay, how do you come up with an E? earnestness. They were very earnest. And I remember doing this. But the R, reliance on the Holy Spirit, which is what dominates the book of Acts. And then I supported it as it went through there like that. And I probably wouldn't have won any preaching contest, but the Lord used that night. We had a lot of folks come to the altar, and I thought, this is pretty cool. And I started taking advantage of every opportunity I got, working here at the camp in the summers. I had the privilege of leading the youth program for the family camps, and I got to preach to the teenagers and do their youth program. So it was just a natural thing, the direction I was heading. And God just put me through some open doors. When I looked back, I thought, you know, I'm called to preach. If I don't preach, I'm going to be out of the will of God. And that's how it worked with me. And I know for all of you, you probably can go back and you can establish that different stage. But it all begins, again, with that call of God on our lives. And I'm a firm believer, if God has called you, you need to be as prepared as you can. So get all the education you can. But it's not about the letters after your name. It's all about what you're learning. And you should be a lifelong learner. And I know I got really more education out of college than I got in college. I think all of you would probably agree with me on that. But the call of God on our lives is the first phase right there. And the basis of a long-time ministry is going to be having this good start and, again, understanding this. And whenever I get to a point in my life where I'm just hitting a wall, anybody ever hit a wall? And I, to be honest with you, I'm that place in a lot of ways right now. I'm just beating my head up against a wall right now. And I get there and I have to step back and think, okay, God, you called me. And if God has called us to do this, He's going to empower us to do exactly what He wants us to do. He didn't say it was going to be comfortable all the time. He didn't say it was going to be hunky-dory. I got that out of the Greek. but that's the call phase. Now, when you get that call, you could also talk about your call to a particular church. And this is kind of what I want to focus on a little bit today, because we've been called, and some of you stepped through a door of missions. We have several missionaries in here where you decided you were going to go. God led you to a certain place. A part of all of these equations is your wife. And at this stage, a lot of times, we don't have children. But older guys are called. And sometimes when that happens, children are there. And I think they need to be involved in that whole process. But let's lead to the second phase. Because you've now been called to a ministry. You've been called by a church. For example, I was called to Tabernacle in Wilson. And when you go to Wilson, somebody described that first year when you're in a new church. And yeah, do you see the blank there? It starts with the letter H. What was it called? The honeymoon. You're in the honeymoon. Now, a lot of parallels to what we're experiencing here in the phases of ministry are going to be very similar to a marriage. And think about your relationship with your wife. Again, I met Joanna here at the Wild. She was at Tennessee Temple. I was at Bob Jones. We didn't really date a lot because we just didn't see each other a lot. We were just best of friends. She was a year older than me, teaching at Tennessee Temple Academy. I was a senior at Bob Jones. I was a hall leader, resident assistant there in the dorm, and I ended up having to be around campus a lot. So I didn't get to go see her, but she came to visit us for a party that the Wilds, they were having the Wild staff get together. Next month, she came down for our dating outing. I met her over in Atlanta. We got together one time for that. And then next thing you know, we're going into Thanksgiving's coming up, and she's going to talk to her parents about me. And then December, I'm asking her dad for the permission to marry her. We ended up getting engaged in February. And what was funny is there were 6 hall leaders in each dorm, and every single one of them were dating somebody at the beginning of the year. I wasn't dating anybody. I was the first one to get married. Because we got married that August right after camp. We worked that summer together at camp. But that, what was really cool, we took, what's that, Taylor Johnson? Is that what it's called? The Taylor Johnson inventory test. We did that. Ken Collier did our premarital counseling with us. Marty, Ken and Marty did. And they looked at our scores and they said, we've got people that's been married 20 years that have never matched any better than you have. Wow. I mean, so, you know, if it was internet, we would have done match.com. And, man, we would have founded this thing. We had it figured out. You know why? Because we had this idea of what it was going to be like. I mean, I was marrying the perfect woman, and she was marrying the perfect husband. And then we got married and we went on a honeymoon and it was wonderful. Now, I'm not just talking about getting away on a vacation. I'm talking about we started to really get to know each other. But when you start to get to know each other, what starts to happen? You start to think, okay, wait a second. I didn't know that about you. And I didn't know that about you. And it's the same way in a church, because what happens when a pulpit committee starts interviewing this pastor and they come to the conclusion, hey, this is the perfect guy for this ministry. And they go back, he can preach, he has interpersonal relationship skills, this guy is able to connect with people, the young people like him, and you have all this stuff going that's at play here. And then the pastor's looking at a church, look at the potential, they've got nice facilities, they've got their Sunday school organized, everything's great there. And you have this honeymoon phase, but it's not too far into that. And for some, and I would put it down, it lasts about a year. And for the typical person, it may be a year, maybe 2 years. For some, if you do something really boneheaded, it might only last a month. You go through this honeymoon phase, but eventually somewhere along the line, it comes to this point where, okay, wait a second. I didn't know this about this church. It's not a, and by the way, there's no such thing as a perfect church. And the church needs to understand there's no such thing as a perfect pastor also. So you experience this phase of ministry. And as a young guy, and I can remember when I went to Rock Hill to start Harvest Baptist Church, I was going to build the world's largest church right there in Rock Hill. I mean, it was, we're a bedroom community to Charlotte. We've got everything we need to do this. And I can still remember as a young church planter standing at the window of the mini daycare building, mini gym in the daycare building, looking out where we were renting, looking out and watching cars pull in the parking lot. Yeah, we have some visitors today, only to see them turn around and go the different direction because they were just making the wrong turn. And I'm like, oh, man. And I was humbled very quickly. You have that youthful idealism, and all of that is part of that honeymoon phase or those early stages. The risk-taking stage, if you put it on your timeline of where you are. Churches are very similar to that too. The next phase, what we'll call, is the adjustment phase. Okay. The adjustment phase, again, understanding that the church isn't perfect, understanding that the pastor's not perfect, we start to begin to understand the different imperfections that are there. And like any kind of couple, say a newlywed couple there, we begin to experience some of the differences that are there. And what really is going to be the key during this adjustment phase is going to be the health of the church, not how big your church is. Not how much money you're taking in, because all of that eventually is going to be affected by the bottom line key, which is health. Is it healthy? You see, you can be big and not be healthy. Some of us are big, but not that healthy. You know what I mean? It's very key now for the health of the church, very key for the health of the pastor, and here very key for the health of his family, how you're going to come out in these years. We'll say this lasts about 2 or 3 years, or year two, three. It may last 2 or 3 years, the time period after the honeymoon. And the reason I say this is so key is because it's at this phase that we're leading to right now that affects most pastors. In fact, if you study just about any metrics that are out there, you're going to find that the average tenure of a pastor today is about 3 to 4 years. And that's hard to take, because I don't think God calls somebody to a ministry. I'm not saying that he doesn't lead people away. And I know he did that in our lives at times. And if you look at my life, I was in Rock Hill for 4 years. I was in Muncie for 4 years. I was in North Carolina for 10 years. I've been now at Oakwood for 4 and a half, going on 5 years, and we're right there in these phases that what we're talking about, where I can identify with all of the research that's been compiled there. Now, this adjustment phase right here is going to be very clear, because if I have a healthy church, what's a healthy church? Somebody help me out. How would you define a healthy church?
Growing church.
Okay. Where there's life, there's going to be growth. If there's real life there, there's going to be growth. Now, is that going to be necessarily, how do I define growth? Because that's important too.
Spiritual.
Okay, spiritual growth is the primary measuring stick for this, is true. Right. There's got to be the vertical, not necessarily that I'm just out here. Now, I do believe, and I think Rusty's talking about that, God's desire for the church, his design for the church, is for the church to grow numerically. And you look at that, God is concerned about numbers because every number represents a person. There's a book in the Bible called Numbers. You know, the numbers, when you look at the book of Acts, they're being counted. So I'm not against that, but it's spiritual growth that's going to determine health right there, not numerical growth. And so we have a growing church, a church that's really settled in. Why do we do what we do? You know why we do what we do a lot of times? Because we've always done it that way. That's why we do what we do. Even the discussion we had over breakfast this morning a little bit, which went off on a little area there that, you know, why, how does this play out? Well, that's what we've always done. Well, maybe we need to think outside the box some. Because honestly, if you look at where we are in America today and American churches, and I've told our church, I'm sick of American Christianity. I've been on the mission field. The Lord's given me the privilege to travel to different countries, and I see something that's real. And I'm not saying there aren't people in our congregations that aren't real, but I'm saying just the way we do things, we get so rooted in our tradition. Now, if I'm healthy, it's not about this is what I've always done. I'm going to be measuring everything here. Now, if I'm really healthy by growth and I'm measuring this stuff on the foundation of this book, that's setting the standard for what I'm going to do. This will determine how I'm going to play it out in the days ahead. Because the next phase is what you'll see here. I've labeled it the crisis phase. And you'll notice I labeled it crisis number one. What does that tell you if it's crisis number one?
It's going to come again.
There's another crisis that's going to come, and it's very important. And if you look at the statistics of pastors, and again, I don't think you can say that it's going to be always this way, but there seems to be a normal plan that kind of plays out in the way God has worked and the way God has directed in different ministries here. And this, again, is now a very, very key part in the relationship of the pastor and his church, because it's at this phase where most pastors are forced out. And we would put this probably around year 4, 5, 6, somewhere around there. And if you look, again, and I look back on my own ministry, this was very, very key. I look at the 10 years I was in at Tabernacle, and I can remember the crisis that happened around that time. And I'm not going to go into the details of all of that, but I can remember driving down the road by myself one time, and I'm praying to the Lord, and as I'm driving, I'm thinking, Lord, I don't know what you're preparing me for. I'm just saying, okay, if it's this bad now, what's it going to be like out there? And since then, I've seen God along the journey preparing me and training me and getting me put in a position, you know, to be able to apply what I've learned through the years. But this is such a key phase right here, because this year right now, again, is the time when most pastors are going to leave their particular church. But if we can manage this time well, and we can push through this time here, then what normally happens right after that is it leads us to the next phase of ministry, which is the harvest phase. Or this is the phase of growth and fruit. And I'm talking about genuine trust, because I know my church. I know their imperfections. They know me. They know my imperfections. But we've trusted each other. Now, let me tell you something very key here. And I think that this is important. I don't think it's always true that God calls a person to a church and he's going to be there for life. I know there are times where God calls somebody and he's there for such a time as this. He's there for the need there, and then the Lord uses him. And I know in a way, there's been a couple times in my ministry where I felt like I had gotten as far as I could go with somebody, and it was time to hand the baton to somebody else. And it's almost like a coaching tenure. Have you noticed the parallels between coaching and pastoring? It's very similar in things like this. And it's not about us, and it's about the program, you hear. So there's something more important than just me at play. But I do believe God calls people to a ministry, and if he calls them to that ministry, he wants to equip them to be there. And we don't need to make it about us, even though it's uncomfortable at times. And so what I have discovered that is if we can go in it with an attitude, okay, God called me here. Just like in a marriage. When the times get tough, when we have an argument or a discussion, that's what my wife and I do, we discuss. Rather firmly at times. We have these discussions, and then we have to think, okay, what are we going to do now? And it helps us to step back and look at the big picture. Even in this phase right here, look at the big picture. I've had people in my ministry, let me just tell you a little bit about our situation in North Carolina. We were there for 10 years. When I first went there, year one, there was discussion about relocating the church. This church was started by Dr. Otis Holmes. You know, he's head of church planning department at BJ for many years. Dr. Bob Jones Jr. Had his membership in this church up in Wilson for all of his, you know, later years. When he died, he was a member of a Tabernacle Baptist Church in Wilson. Historic area, people that had built that church. Ruby Parker, that was Monroe Parker's wife when he died. She was a member of my church. Charter member from the church, too. A lot of stuff had worked around there. Somebody know the name Charles Britt. He was a former pastor there, too. Randy Carroll was a former pastor there. Roy Wise was a former pastor. So being a part of that particular ministry, I came in and, you know, it was one of those things, like I said earlier, man, this, look at all this, wow. And then I realized these were people, and they were sinners, and they smelled like sheep. You see what I'm saying? And they got to know me, and we went through some of this here around year 4 and 5. And then what we experienced on the backside of that, you'll notice crisis phase number 2. This is around 10 years or sometime just after this. This was when we were there. We went in with the conversations of relocating the church. That started back in 2000 when I first went there. I told my wife this is a 10-year plan, and in 2010 we had already started the process of relocating. I'm not going to go through all the details we did. The church has since relocated. I had involved the people in the church. I had gotten all of the deacons, all the former deacons, our school board, and I'd gotten a group of men that weren't deacon qualified but were really godly men. I'm talking about guys that had been divorced way back or something like that, but they were really godly and had proven themselves. And I brought these solid men together and formed what we called a forward focus team. I gave them a 30-day devotional guide. I told them, I want you to pray about this, don't talk, there is no agenda, we want the Lord's will. It was 30 days about the idea of possibly relocating. After 30 days, we came back into a man that was unanimous that they wanted us to relocate out by the school, about 4 miles away. Our area was declining. The neighborhood around us was now community housing. We did a crime report on our neighborhood and turned out in a year and a half, it was a year and a half study, in that time there were 30 lines per page, 27 pages of felony offenses within a quarter mile of our church. We let the police be on the third floor of educational buildings staking out drug houses around there. God was protecting us where we were, but it was obvious it was time to get out, but it was a hard time for some of those charter members because it was unanimous that they felt like we needed to move. Well, in the process of discussing that, I took it before the church. Okay, I want you all to do a 30-day devotional guide. No agenda. I don't want you talking amongst each other. We're not debating this. Let's pray and ask God. We'll come back in 30 days, and then we'll talk. Right after that service, one of those charter members, one of those godly ladies, walks right up the aisle to me. She says, Pastor, I'm going to fight you on this. And I told her, I said, there's no agenda. We just really want the Lord's will. The next week, I was preaching through the churches in Revelation. And is it the church of Sardis that talks about the synagogue of Satan? Is that the church? It's one of them. But maybe it's, anyway, it talks about the synagogue of Satan. And I made the comment that the devil has his crowd in every church. Whew. My words were twisted on that one. She came to see me. Another lady came to see me the next day. And she says to me, she says, Pastor. And I just loving on her, being friendly. And she says, I don't like what you're doing with our church. She said, I wish all these young people would just leave and they can go out and go out to the school and have their church out there. But we built this church. You know, a lot of emotion. She was a charter member. And she said, and here you are calling us the devil. I said, what? Yeah, yesterday you said, and I said, and I'm processing. Okay, I said, the devil has a crowd in every church. She's thinking that. And she says, and I think you're the biggest devil here. Now you respond to that. I just loved on her, tried to be sweet to her. God, you're going to have to fight this battle. Honestly, she was in the hospital the next day. Had another man came up to me shortly after that. Well, he didn't come to me. He went to one of the deacons. He says, there's going to be trouble if pastor keeps doing this. I'm talking about crisis number two here. There's going to be trouble if pastor keeps doing this. And he said, honestly, and that deacon got really, really upset. That man was in the hospital the next day. And the Lord was doing something, and I was just letting him do something there. And this was all at the same time that my dad passed away unexpectedly. This was at the time I got a call from Oakwood. And I'm hitting the walls there, and I'm looking for these men to step up behind me that totally believed this, but they weren't publicly supporting that. And it got to the point where it had to be, okay, if we were going to go forward, I needed to get out of the way because it was becoming personal. And they needed to carry the ball. It was a hard thing because I've got a great relationship. We left on good terms there. But the Lord was closing a door there and he was opening another door. And that's always how it works. Now, if somehow this crisis phase, the second crisis, we can push through, what normally happens is at the end of the time of a pastor that's been there for all these years, if he's going to decide, is it time for a new challenge? Which it very well may be. Or am I just going to put it on cruise control? And we've all seen that happen before too. Where we just, because where we're eventually heading to the last phase down here is the legacy phase. And these are the latter years. Because the pastors think, okay, what's my legacy going to be? And sometimes we play it safe. And I've seen a lot of pastors, we could probably have testimonies right here about pastors that have gotten to this point. And you've been an assistant. You know what it's like when you're that assistant in a particular ministry where you're coming up with ideas wanting to do stuff. But we get a little. And I think just like a person does in their own life, those of you that are younger that are just starting out, I mean, you're probably willing to think outside the box a little more than somebody that's been around for a long time because now we're kind of protecting our legacy a little bit. Brother Dale, you know, you can identify. You know what I'm talking about. You get to this thought. Now, I know a lot of guys that are progressive thinking and they're willing to put it all on the scriptures and all. And the key is with the legacy here is being able to think about the next generation. We had some discussion over breakfast this morning about how are we going to reach younger guys. And I think the whole key is that we're always thinking about the next generation. Remember the book of Judges? Book of Judges is a great story there, but you do just one thing after the other. It's just the failures that are taking place. And the key failure you find right in chapter 1 and chapter 2, particularly in chapter 2 where it says, there arose another generation that knew not God. Now think about this. This was the children of the people that had just, I mean, these are folks that just earlier within a generation or two had seen God send plagues. They had seen the Jordan part when the priests put their feet in the water. But there arose another generation that didn't know the Lord. Well, now, why not? Well, we failed to give the legacy that we should have given along the way. And thus begins the cycle of problems all the way down the last. And one of the things I really think here is that the idea of training future generations and, again, finishing strong, there's so much that could be said about this. And, you know, generally I think this stage probably starts when, you know, if it plays out and God gives us our 70 years or whatever, it generally starts when you're around my age, when you start really thinking about, okay, what's going to happen next. You know, I'm very concerned about my kids, my son particularly 22 years old, and his buddies. I'm really concerned about that. This past summer I was at camp, and I remember I was with Sam Horn. We were out here at the lake just sitting out here talking, and we were talking about some of some of the kids. Rusty's got a son that graduated. You know Scott, who just graduated a year or so ago, and concerned about them. I talked to Jeremy Sweat. I was with Jeremy a while back talking about his boys. And I'm really concerned about these next generations and what's going to happen with them. And I want to be sure that we're teaching them and selling them not just on, okay, this is what we've always done, but have a place to anchor. Because at the end of the day, this is what endures forever. And this is one. And one of the things I found with my own family, and it goes back to the idea of submitting yourselves one to another, is the idea that I'm not the dictator, but I'm involving them in the conversation and involving them in different choices that we make along the way, and trying to involve them in the discussions that we have, and trying to get to a point of not, this is what we do. I don't know how many of you ever heard. I heard my dad say this to me before. I was like, why? And he said, because I said so. Mm-hmm. And I think as a dad, I've probably used that before, because I said so. But that's not sufficient. That's not good enough. When you say why, you have to have a reason beyond that. Now, ultimately, if dad says so, that's enough. But as a dad, I need to submit myself to a point where I'm willing to show and share why. And so when future generations, when we're thinking about this, we're thinking about our legacy, what are we going to leave behind? I told our staff when I first went to Oakwood, and when I moved to Oakwood, I think I was 42 years old, I said to them, I said, it is our job to replace ourselves. And that's where we all need to be thinking. Because none of us are guaranteed another day. We want to be replacing ourselves. And I know the Wilds is going through that right now. What are our next steps? I know the Lord's going to give Steve many, many more years, but Steve's in that process of thinking, okay, what's my next step? Who are we going to hand this off to? And so this is the legacy that we get through. Now, if you think through those different phases, one of the things, and our time's almost gone, but there are things that I really want us to consider in this, because along that journey, there needs to be practical ways that we're going to be able to support our family through these different things, these different stages. It's so easy to get so caught up with ministry and miss your number one ministry, and that's your family. And I wish I had time to give you all, because I've got all kind of practical ideas on doing this, but I want us just to consider a few things really quickly here, because specifically to my family as a whole, there are different things that I can do as a dad to submit myself. And the first key to that is making time for your family. And I'm talking about time to not only shepherd your people, but to shepherd your family. Not only to lead your church in worship, but to lead your family in worship. Family worship, I think for us, is one of the toughest things that we face through the years. Our schedules, and as the kids get older, ball games, schedules, it's not that we're sitting down at meals together all the time, because we're going so many different directions. Things have just, I mean, we're not living on the prairie anymore, you know? And we're having to adapt and come up with different ways. One of the things I know my wife was talking about this morning, she was talking about some things that have changed through the years, and she was talking about how technology has changed things. But technology doesn't have to be the evil, you know, opponent to us. We can use that in a way. I love it when I get a text message from my wife saying, sharing a Bible verse that the Lord has taught her to something today, and it's a group text to our entire family. Or I'm sharing something, please pray for Bethany, she has this big exam coming up later, and it's a group text to our entire family on things like that. So you can use the technology in a way that is appealing there, but make them a part of that. And by the way, with technology, let me say this one thing with your family. I read an article just this past week about a guy that was going on vacation. I don't know how many of you take vacations. If you take a vacation, it's not vacation a lot of times, because you got your cell phone there and your laptop. At least for me, I'm one of those that if I don't have my cell phone, I'm not going to have a good vacation, because I'm going to be worried about what's going on. But disconnect as much as you can. One guy described how he dropped his phone into the water, tried to dry it out, didn't work. You know what? The world didn't end. He was on vacation. Everything happened. You know, you're not that important. He said he had tried to dry it out. He tried to do this. He said he turned it on just out of, you know, just being silly at the end of the week, and it worked. He said it's been working ever since. So God wants us to disconnect too, so we can give that priority. So there's a lot of things that we can do. But let me play this out real quickly, specifically to my wife. In their book, Pastors at Greater Risk, London and Wiseman say that wives, 25% of them see their husband's work schedule as a source of conflict. 80% of pastors say that they have insufficient time with their spouse. You know, there's several different ways or reasons that things are happening in our world like that with that. One thing is the competing vows that we made. You know, we made a vow to God to preach, to be that preacher, but we also made a vow to our wives, and sometimes they... So that's a real struggle. There's that incessant emotional overload. Most people can't identify with the struggle that we face as pastors. They don't know the backstory behind you're making a decision and they think, why did he do that? And there are 14 variables that are at play here. They don't know that you were just counseling with somebody that was contemplating suicide or a family that just was thinking about a divorce. They don't understand that. These are issues. And we bring those home. And sometimes it's really hard for our wives with that. And then our schedules are just going so many different directions. I would just encourage you very simply, don't try to salvage everything by just setting up a date night. I think you need to date your wife. But it needs to be more than that. It needs to become a priority. And I wish I had time to go through the list of things that we can do. But honestly, if you just step and just think about this specifically, how can I involve my wife through these different phases that I'm going through where she is a key part? I'm going to submit myself. I'm going to make her the priority. And the same thing would go to my children. Don't just set up a time where you involve them in your ministry. I want my kids at the end of the day, even through the turmoil that they know I'm facing, not to hate the ministry. I want them to know that God is real in the midst of all of this and see God working and see God putting people in the hospital if that's what He decides to do. And I want them to see that it's worth the hurt, because when you step back and look at it, that what is killing you right now in the turmoil you're facing, whatever phase you're in right now, step back and look at all the victories and good things God has given you and what you have been able to accomplish. And celebrate that with your family. Our time's gone. I wish we could really get into those. But I would encourage you just to take as way of personal application to go through those. Yes, sir.
Jeff, I have a question. And maybe if you don't, maybe somebody else here might have the answer. You mentioned in the kind of the crisis and harvest stage, you talked about the trust that's developed.
Right.
Does anybody, is that a, you know, 4 to 6 years, I just celebrated my 5th anniversary of the church I'm at.
Right.
But I was the 5th pastor in 12-year period.
Yes. Oh, my.
Does it come, I mean, I'm not feeling the trust yet.
Okay, I get it, but I think you're on the way there. But I think that they need to be communicated to these phases, what I'm saying right here. They need to understand that, what is going on. And there are tons of resources that are out there, and I can help you with some that are like that, where they can understand. And I don't think what I've just told you from a practical standpoint is impractical to at least share with your leaders. And I've shared these things with our leaders to let them know that, yeah, I'm feeling some pressure, even from a couple guys right now that are leaders in our church. And I'm thinking, guys, this is normal. But go back, just like what I just said, go back and think about, yeah, you're looking at me just like a husband and a wife because she rolls the she squeezes the toothpaste in a certain way, or she rolls the toilet paper a different direction. And we're looking at those little things. Look at all this bigger stuff, the bigger picture, and look at my heart and look who we are. And let's get to, and then it's just spending time with your key leaders to get that kind of trust. There's always going to be the questioning of the pastor, wherever you are, there's always going to be turmoil and all. And I understand what you're saying, because in Wilson, I faced a little bit of that the same. But the thing that got us to where we got, where we were able to grow, where we were able to relocate, was me investing with key deacons. I had young deacons coming on board, spending time with them, and they were my biggest supporters when it came to some of the other. And that was the folks that related, had been there for a long, long time, too. So I think that's going to be key.